Blog Talk Radio.
The Sonic Effects been ongoing since December 2010. What's that make us, foolish or just committed? You're an audacious group out there, Freemasons. Nice to join you again. We're going to talk today. We're going to apply a few ideas that have been floating around in the back of the mind. Today it's kind of interesting, I think, to witness the power that's on the face of the earth. None of it seems to be man-made. We are sitting on this planet, and a lot of us are products of you know, really outdated superstition in our early education. We weren't taught by enlightened minds, because the enlightened minds weren't necessarily rushing to the classroom. We've lost that day of sitting at the knee of Plato and following him around the hillsides. It's just not practical. Even in that day, the workers didn't do it. It was the children, the young men, and of the gentry that were able to have that leisure time to use productively. And today, the power is insurmountable. It's undeniable. To think that there is no science behind the creation is, I think, remarkable, and that's something I have to apologize to with an audience of Freemasons, of course. Of course not. That's why I wanted to make the commentary today about Blinded by the Light, riding on this wave of optimism. Freemasonry is, if nothing else, at its foundation, an opportunity for enlightenment. But I think there are challenges. And along the way, as we become more enlightened, we strip away the politics, we strip away the superstition. We look at whatever reality is and create an understanding of everything around us. So today we have we're going to be following that wave of optimism, that light wave. Or there might be some of you particle theorists out there that are saying, Dale, all light is particles. Well, yeah, to you too. Here, we'll get into a good frame of mind together. I think you're going to enjoy the program. Sit back, grab that comfortable mug of whatever you have in mind, and have at it. It's going to be you only have yourself to blame for this one. I can tell you that right now. This is a good program, and I do pay very, very careful attention to what you've got to say and the things that you struggle to talk about openly in the lodge. So sit back. Here's a little brain worm from a Canadian singer, Sophie Millman. That will help us along our path this morning. One of the pure pleasures of being a human is to be able to let yourself go into the sound of a beautiful voice. Somehow it soothes us. Students out there of Pythagoras will certainly embrace that kind of thinking. Then the question for you and me, the likes of us, is how does that happen? How does the mathematics of music transcend us? How? There is a connection. Even though we might not understand it, there's a lot that we don't understand along this path of enlightenment. Excuse me. One of the things that we have to realize that is along that path, reality isn't smiles and chuckles and silliness. It is what it is. Is it that it seems in my mind that balance point, almost from a molecular level, you know, different forces with opposite properties creating a balance. That means our tendency, the frailty of the human condition, is to notice for a lot of people, and I think it's temperament that drives this, is to notice unpleasantness, the imperfection. Some people are very good at it, you know, they'll notice that they'll only be around you, and these are people that I don't care for very much. They'll only be around and animated as long as they know they can get something from you. And as soon as you don't fit that scale, they move on. Those are folks I have learned very little in common with. Because they're a bit obvious. But we have to be able to resolve our own tendency to feel overwhelmed by our abilities to understand the cycles around us. All right, now I'm looking at a very old maple tree. She's about 30 years old, and she's maybe a little older. She's suffering from age and wear and tear, and her shade is just so pleasant all summer, but she she's dying, so I have to do something to take her out. Do I feel, you know, is that like a, oh my goodness, there's an excuse that life is meager because something that I enjoy is passing? Or is it a little bit of a reality check that all things pass? We're sitting on this dynamic, living planet. The earth is not dead. That's what we were often taught. The earth is not dead. It's living. It's changing. It's morphing every single day, even now, underneath our oceans. In Ecuador, our brethren are experiencing massive earthquakes, and in Japan. This isn't like evolution or change waits for us. The rules of nature are unremitted. They are what the experience that reminds us. We may be able to create hell on earth by incinerating hundreds of thousands of people at one time with weaponry, but that pales by comparison with the power of a tsunami or even the power of a wave. Waves that can travel at 7,000 kilometers. A wave isn't the displacement of water, it's energy. The earthquake comes, it leaves what? Change behind. You and I look at it in terms of the suffering, the people. Even though we know we're sitting on earthquake zones, we'll continue to live there because it is, after all, our free choice. So if we left those areas for safety, and I believe a lot of people have, we won't read about them in the headlines of a newspaper. So living on the edge of the ocean for a lot of the major cities now is just playing with the Grim Reaper. The ocean levels are rising. Our scientists, our mathematicians, our school children can calculate when the water levels of the oceans are going to flood Miami or flood New York or travel up the Thames and hit London or Paris. I don't want these things to happen. Of course, I'm selfish like a lot of people. That's my struggle with enlightenment, and I don't think I'm alone in that regard. That conceit, wanting things the way I want them to be. But I'm too old for that. I'm too old for that kind of childishness anymore. I shake my head. I don't even want to engage in the conversation anymore. How do we do this in Masonic Lodge? My goodness. Freemasonry has given us so much. There are so many brilliant, brilliant minds engaged in Freemasonry. Oh, they're not the gentry. They're not the golf and country club core. They're not necessarily the elite, as evidenced by our history. But when we take a careful look at the lives of those people, they're more like us than we care to admit. Oh, I know the imperialists are sharpening their swords and coming after me right now. The colonialists will certainly not like hearing this. We struggle here in this part of the Masonic community with our own particular creature, our own evolution. But it is just that. It's a constant process of evolution. I used to once, it occurred to me that there were a lot of forces holding back. And then I realized there's really nothing holding back, because that's just a concept in the mind. We have some things that we need to have in place so that there's predictability. And that helps us while we're going through this exercise, through this task, through this life, this being. So I'm grateful that our Grand Lodges have been able to do that. I feel absolutely that I failed the Grand Lodge because they seem to struggle with the responsibility for this, for motivating people to learn. And I think that's they have done as much as they possibly can by the fact of their very existence. Our Grand Lodge is opportunity. Now, all of that said, of course, there's questions. Here, let me read the commentary, go over the commentary with you and see what you think of this. How we analyze the process of Freemasonry depends on whether we are approaching our work with the enthusiasm and positivism of our entered apprentices or with cynicism. The start of Freemasonry owes much to the Renaissance, when the corruption of the church and secular war brought it into dispute. Still, the questions did not stop, but the rebirth, Renaissance, sought out a re-examination of pre-Christian thinking. The things that the Christian church had discounted, you know, they created this idea of evil. They created this idea of pagan. You know, look at the lexicon. So we reexamined all of that. A study of ancient Egypt and ancient Greece. Some themes that have leaked into Freemasonry, yeah? The rebirth of those ideas, or what we call the Renaissance, redefined the relationship between God and man. No longer was the church in control, interpreting and dictating the nature of that relationship with the divine. Mankind was no longer corrupt or broken, as the Garden of Eden described. The translation of the Egyptian Book of Thoth into Latin was accepted without challenge to be the lost knowledge restored. No longer subservient, Renaissance man was responsible for carrying out duties. As God created beauty, so it was the responsibility of mankind to create an experience based on aesthetics and science. More than 2,000 years after it was thought to have vanished, the legend of the Book of Thoth led to study of the tarot. That brings us to today. So we look at the work of the entered apprentice. It's different than the old craftsman. And we hope that the old craftsmen are still functioning and superb at their work, because they're expressing an inner journey, a journey of genius. They don't do it on command. Remember, up until about the period of the Renaissance, the patron told the artist what to do. Thank you for the Da Vinci's of the world and the Michelangelo's of the world. Say, no, that's not the work. It will paint your ceiling, but no. Somebody like you, you don't have this genius and this talent. I'll tell you what we're going to paint up there. And the things changed. And then we saw this outpouring of the expression of what it means to be, the diversity of what it means to be a human. Picasso did it. So can you imagine? It's like saying we would have to wait for a patron to come up with the eye of Picasso and tell him to produce it. It's absolutely absurd. Now, I might be able to go up to Mr. Shakespeare and say, you know, I'd like a play. I'd like you to write a play about deception, about madness, about power. And you might say, yeah, I think those are kind of interesting topics. But for me to go up and say, you know, I want you to write a play, and I want the primary character to be Iago, and I'd like you to do something, write a play about Jews and how we treat them. You know, he might not have been able to reach into the recesses of his creativity, unless it was his own. So our path of enlightenment isn't somebody else's path. It's our own. Now, I want to think that the narrative that here on Masonic Effects, we're able to change the narrative. Not create a new narrative, but change what's already there. And largely, I think you'll agree with Vilfredo Pareto's theorem on this, his principle, the 80-20 rule. Roughly what that states is that 80% of the effects come from 20% of the causes. So let's say you're the 1 in 5. Yeah, okay. That the way that this audience collectively approaches Freemasonry can affect change on 80% of the function of Freemasonry. You show that this is a guy that was an economist. Yeah, actually an economist that contributed something that continues to this day. So think about the 80-20 rule. You can apply it in all kinds of manner. It's still being applied in business circles today. You know, it's an odd thing. 80% of problems can be attributed to 20% of causes. So here, you can be the vehicle of change. You are already. It's not like you could be. You are. But what we have to give up, I think, is in changing the narrative, accept the fact that Freemasonry is something beautiful in design and more beautiful in its effect. And we have to be able to become tolerant of the pettiness around us. Not to sway our opinion, but to accept it for what it is. It's inevitable. We can't erase it, or we would. Clearly we would. We become, as we age, tired of the pettiness, the Philistines, people that are callous. When you see something unpleasant going on, where is it necessary? What's the benefit of pointing it out? Human frailty. What's the benefit? Is it that we begin to feel superior? Really? By pointing a finger at the shortcomings of our fellow man? That's all we are. Freemasons are held to a higher standard. We accept that. We need to be able to stop pointing the finger. We're taught to be loving, to be generous, and to expand on these ideas of charity, not as a handout or a matter of reinforcing our meager sense of self-importance. But we have to accept that within the community of Freemasonry, yes, we've attracted peacocks. As absurd as that is, you know, the cut of a man's suit determines his value on the face of the earth. Really? Maybe that's why Plato dressed up. He looked a bit dodgy. He looked a bit homeless in a lot of ways. He wandered around. So, you know, the people with the perfectly coiffed hair and manicure really didn't think much of this fellow. What did you say? This is irony at its most delightful. And yet, why would all of these people follow him around? Because there was an expression of honesty in the man. And it would create questions. Why, if you were so dignified in your manner and in your thoughts, so enlightened, wouldn't you want to dress like one of the senators? One of the leaders? No, why is that necessary? How does that make one? It's like saying somebody that's a celebrity all of a sudden is a genius because they have opinions about something political or military. Really? That's about as specious an argument as it gets, but it sways weak minds all the time. The narrative changes when we accept, not reject, when we accept that there are people so buried in their own ego that they can see nothing else but what pleases and is consistent with their opinions. No need to argue. No need to debate. Accept. What does that personality, that viewpoint, tell you and I? What does it teach us about reality? Does it teach us that the essential nature of humanity is weak in this kind of a so-called privileged existence? Or that throughout time we've always had people needy and doubting? Or that when we've had so much leisure time as we have in this culture, that our minds start to play tricks on us? That we turn internally and notice shortcomings and flaws and become fearful of them and embarrassed and humiliated by them, rather than accepting that we are curious and in the course of developing insight and maturity, we are able to acknowledge these attributes of a healthy mind. And then in the grand scale of things, realize that they're insignificant. You, me, insignificant. We are just passing through the night. We are on a remarkable journey of life. But when we're talking to an entered apprentice about enjoying the journey, it's just dismissive, as if the words have no meaning. And we don't combine that comment over a table with a glass of good wine or good cup of coffee and explain what it is that we're attempting. We're really not fair to that fellow. We're leaving him in a way to scour the experience and search for his own path. And if you're diligent, and if you're of a certain disposition and intelligence, you'll find it. You'll find answers. Remarkably difficult when we seem to hold back. And not to be unkind, it's not because everybody in Freemasonry is clueless and doesn't recognize it. But the emphasis in Freemasonry is often not on contemplative discussion. Have we become compromised as an order? Have we become compromised by the thrift of remaining controversial? How's that? That's not even a bloody word. We'll be right back. Here's a little When You Make Me Smile by Rigmor Gustafsson. Swedish. You'll pick that up. Get up a gear, shall we? Let's jump in and talk about the things that influence our thinking to this day. Those major discoveries or acknowledgments that have penetrated human thought for hundreds and hundreds of years. This is like, remember, we've talked a bit about in previous shows, the first Ionian Revolution. We went from mythology to physics. Plato's theories of ideas treated the whole world of experience as somehow unreal, by contrast to the pure and changeless ideas, according to him, the only real source of knowledge. The Greek physicists had demanded too much too soon. We wouldn't do that if our Masonic brethren, would we? We wouldn't do that if a entered apprentice, would we? Can we begin to impose our interpretations on him? You become a source of revenue. And our marketing is very poor, but we're going to hector you to the grave to ensure that we extract everything that we need. You see, it becomes very meager when we put it that way, doesn't it? Because the underlying principles aren't shared. I think that's a bit unfair. Certainly, the Greek physicists weren't the substantial source of modern science. But we moved on to a second Ionian Revolution. More momentous for the future of a seeking mankind, we found Socrates as its leader and symbol. He made philosophy more intimately personal than ever before. He asked not only what, but whether man knew. Not what we knew, whether we knew. Socrates left no writing and no dogma. His radically human approach to philosophy was expressed in his life. His historic influence would be not in his answers, but in his questions. And he would survive in dialogues, a new literary form of question and answers, followed by more questions and answers towards still more questions. For him, it was the spoken word, the encounter between living people, with the word as the catalyst of thought, that struck sparks. And the spoken word had an enticing elusiveness not found in writing, which always invited scrutiny. Its meaning depended on memory, which also had a special meaning for him. The influence of Socrates, then, was not in the school of philosophy, but in his person. Historians of philosophy separate the pre-Socratics from the Socratics, not because of a new doctrine, but for a new emphasis, a new kind of seeking. His iridescence for later seekers came from his life and the circumstance of his death. Unlike Jesus, Socrates had the misfortune to have his life reported by literary persons. Aristophanes, Xenophon, Plato, and Aristotle, each with his own axe to grind. So a halo of ambiguity surrounds the life of Socrates. And his life has become doubly intriguing because, as Bertrand Russell observed, we really do not know how much we know about the real Socrates. Everything we know about him is reflected in the distorting mirror of another strong personality. The scholar's Socrates problem allows each of us to have our own Socrates. Besides the biographical memoir, Plato had to invent a new literary form, the dialogue, to communicate the meaning of Socrates. No writings of Socrates survived, and his meaning would live in reports of his spoken word. Plato deftly revealed the suspense of the philosopher's quest. We are told that Plato began not as a philosopher, but as a dramatist. He had written tragedies before he met Socrates, but according to tradition, he burned them after he came under the influence of Socrates. Then he used his dramatic talent to interpret a philosopher whose message could be carried only in the spoken word. For a philosopher whose mission was the discovery of ignorance, the Socratic dialogues provided a convenient vehicle. The drama of the living search in Plato's Socratic dialogues was somehow not diminished by their uniformity, inconclusive conclusions. He didn't give you the answer that you need to work to find for yourself. Another subtle Socratic paradox was latent in the dialogues, the idealized art of conversation. Socrates himself repeatedly denied the role of teacher, and he never bores us with the wagging didactic finger. Teacher, you're doing it wrong. But he did boast the role of midwife. As he said, and like the midwives, I am barren, and the reproach which is often made against me that I ask questions of others and have not the wit to answer for myself is very just. The reason is that God compels me to be a midwife, but does not allow me to bring forth. But to me, and the God they owe their delivery, many of them in their ignorance, have gone away too soon, and have not only lost the children of whom I have previously delivered them by an ill bringing up, but have stifled whatever else they had in them by evil communications. The very midwifely technique of which Socrates revealed the general ignorance suggested that truths lay undiscovered within each person being questioned. Don't you love that? Truths lie undiscovered within each person being questioned. So the Socratic technique implied a latent wisdom in everyone. There was a real Socrates. He was born in Athens about 469 BC. His father probably was a prosperous stonemason or sculptor, and Socrates himself may have begun learning the sculptor's craft. I love the connection with masonry, don't you? His early years seem to have been conventional enough. He served as a hoplite, was a member of a heavily armed infantry. These were citizens not wealthy enough to provide themselves with cavalry horses, but able to afford the heavy body armor that we associate with the Greek warrior, a helmet with nasal and cheek pieces, a breastplate and greaves for the leg below the knee. His chief defense was a heavy bronze shield, circular or elliptical, attached to the left arm. For weapons, he carried a short, straight iron sword and a 9-foot spear ready for thrusting. Burdened with his heavy armor, well-drilled hoplites in proper formation could resist archers or cavalry. Fighting for Athens in the Great Peloponnesian War, Socrates acquired a reputation for endurance and courage. It's hard to imagine the squat, diffident Socrates known to historians of philosophy in this belligerent, macho role. But it was his feats on the battlefield that first brought him a citywide reputation in Athens. I was with him in the retreat, his companion Lucius reported of him in Delium in 424. And if everyone were like Socrates, our city would never have come to disaster. During the expedition to Potia, he saved the life of Eschiabiedas, who will play a troublesome role for Socrates in the chaotic politics of his maturity. Socrates reputedly refused to take part in politics. For holding office, he said, would require sacrifice of his principles. As a citizen, he showed conspicuous courage. In 406, as a member of the Bureau, or Legislative Council, he alone stood out against popular demand that some accused generals be tried en masse instead of individually as the law required. Membership on this council was not a political office, but only a routine citizen's duty. 2 years later, when the oligarchy of the 30 tyrants tried to implicate Socrates in their acts of judicial murder, his friends went along. But at risk of his life, Socrates stood firm. His independence then would have been fatal if there had not been a counter-revolution the next year restoring the democracy. And the same independence of spirit would lead to his trial in 399 BC. For introducing strange gods and corrupting youth. How did the city's admired model soldier become an insufferable gadfly, a martyr to the independent mind? We have no solid autobiographical evidence that helps answer that. And only the tendentious accounts of envious and adoring philosophers and historians. Still, despite the confusing evidence, there is incandescent coherence in the legendary Socrates. We lay newcomers to the problem of Socrates must marvel at how the desperate rays of contradictory testimony collect into a brilliant beacon illuminating the philosopher's endless quest. If ever there was a man with a vocation, it was surely Socrates. Yet how and when he heard the call, we do not know. There is no evidence of him being a member of any orthodox religious sect, but there were legends of his occasional sensing a divine sign, like when he called the customary sign. There's simple, ample evidence that he was not governed by the prosaic syllogism. When it might have incriminated him in his final speech of the court, Socrates recalled his periodic mystic experience. I experience a certain divine or demonic something, which in fact Meletus has caricaturized in the indictment. It began in childhood and has been with me ever since, a kind of voice, which whenever I hear it, it always turns me back from something I was going to do, but never urges me to act. This is what has prevented me from taking part in politics. Among the remarkable qualities of Socrates, he was never seen drunk. He had an astonishing fortitude and endurance. One morning he was thinking about something which he could not resolve, and he would not give it up, but continued thinking from early dawn until noon. And there he stood, fixed in thought. And at noon, attention was drawn to him, and the rumor ran through the wondering crowd that Socrates had been standing and thinking about something ever since the break of day. At last, in the evening after supper, some Ionians, out of curiosity, brought out their mats and slept in the open air that they may watch him and see whether he would stand all night. There he stood until the following morning. And with the return of light, he offered a prayer to the sun and went his way. So, we owe much to the mind of a man who left us with the sense that the search for knowledge is a matter of the questions asked, not the answers found. Here. Let's bring it home tonight. The little Thelonious Monk. This is from 1998 album. Very spiritual man was Thelonious. Very mystic, eh? Thank you. Mystic Ophelia. Mystic Ophelia. I'm going to bring this home today with, just try and tie this together. Do you accept in your own way that there is latent knowledge inside each person that we meet? So, if you do, if we accept the innovation of thought, in a way, that Socrates outlines, then what is the question you ask about yourself and about Freemasonry right now? There isn't one secret or one lost word. There is this lost word and then the next question and the next lost word. So what is the question that you ask, the penetrating question that you need answered about your path to enlightenment, your search? What is that? And if you find it, will you know it? If you've already found it. Not the clamor and the politics of Masonic order. We need leadership. Oh my goodness, yes. Beacons, the leaders are beacons of hope. So, let the pettiness wash off us first. And see them for what they are and whom they are. Not with any sense necessarily of aggrandizement, but the reality. Not with the sense that they have turned inward instead of contributing something meaningful to the overall. Perhaps these folks are stewards, and they're there to make sure that we're in good order when they leave as when they came in. And the specialness of any Grand Master is us. What we take away, what we take away. So if you're fixed on looking at all of the shortcomings and problems, you're really wrestling with the fact that another person's mind is not connected with your own. In other words, there's two separate minds at work, two separate personalities at work. And so if we're hopeful that we're going to find symmetry in that, well, really, really? Which one of you are going to give up your uniqueness in your history in order to do that? Which one of you can erase his history? So do the math. Enjoy the harmonics for what they are. Not that the second oboe hung on to a note too long. Oh, well, you know, we can refine that in rehearsal next time. But what was the overall experience? Was it magical? You sit down with something beautiful and all you can come away with is a flaw in it. Oh, my goodness. The question is, what's wrong with you? What's wrong with that? That's the way you've trained your mind and you feel satisfaction? I ain't buying it. That's the person that's on the outside looking in, always competing with the meagerness of his own thought. If you're looking to find enlightenment, it's an acceptance. It's that fantastic discovery. Not so bad. But you have questions that you're not answering yet. Well, that's not because anybody has insight. That's a fact. Well, do you even know what questions you have to you're asking? Let's hope that Freemasonry brings that to a focus. And then let's declare that Freemasonry does produce a tremendous amount of opportunity, and there are men that gain on that path. And will they say that they've reached a state of enlightenment? Probably not. But there may be some amongst us who do. And how will we know them if we meet them? And how do we know how close you and I are to our own state of enlightenment? And isn't it pure joy that we live a life in a state of learning? It's a pleasure to be with Freemasons like you and guests, whoever they are. I hope you'll come back and join us next week. We're looking forward to it. We're going to talk about the challenge of the path to enlightenment. And my question for this one is, what is success but reality unvarnished? That's my thinking right now. Who knows what we'll get into here. This will send you offshore with a smile on your face. Enjoy. It's a pleasure. See you soon.
Somewhere beyond the sea, somewhere waiting for me, my lover sings on golden sails and watches the ship that goes
somewhere beyond. all there waiting.
Take care of each other. We'll see you again real soon. Bye for now.